So let me begin by reading from Luke chapter 9, a passage you probably might think a little odd to use as a Thanksgiving Day message text. But I hope I can weave that together for you before I'm done. So Luke chapter 9, verses 28 to 36. Jesus took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. And they spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. And here's the verse I would really like you to pay attention to for this message today. It's the one I want to focus on. The disciples, after experiencing all of this, this amazing thing, Peter, James, and John, the disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen. So let's bow together in prayer. God of light and wisdom, on this Thanksgiving Sunday, may we become fully aware of the radiance of your glory revealed through your word and through all that is. Amen. Well, different things for different people stir the heart, depending on, I guess, what we're most inspired by. Part of our family Thanksgiving, and I'm sure many of you have this same ritual, is when we sit down to our meal, we'll ask everybody to kind of go around the table and say what it is in the past year that they're most thankful for. How many people do that as part of their Thanksgiving? Now, my one son, John, has consistently said corn. You know, he doesn't put a lot of effort into it, but at least we know he's grateful for the corn. And more recently, he's been grateful for other people who like corn. So anyway, that's one of the ways that we do it. But for me, when I think of Thanksgiving, the concepts of awe and gratitude are inextricably mixed and connected with one another. These awe-inspiring moments evoke a deep and voluntary spiritual response that, for me, feels a lot like the disciples might have felt in the passage that I read. Imagine going up on the mountain, having this amazing vision, and being a part of that experience. Some of you who are here may remember Neil Hamlin, who died in the early 2000s. He was virtually a charter member here. I spent a lot of time with Neil when I pastored this congregation back then. And I won't get into all the details of that relationship other than to say that it was very rewarding on a number of different levels. And, you know, we used to go out to lunch once every couple of weeks, and every so often he'd pay, and that's wonderful enough. But I really grew to care for him and for his family very deeply during that time. And I was privileged, even though I wasn't pastor here at the time, to be able to lead his celebration of life when he passed away. And as often is the case in the life of a pastor, I'm sure John, you'll relate to this, I didn't have a lot of time after Neil died to process my own feelings. I was busy doing all of the things that are pastoral, that a person who is meeting with the family and caring for some of the needs that they have, spending time planning the event, making sure that it was honoring to the person that he was, making sure that I was able to bring some comfort to those who were struggling with the loss. And so I'm not sure that I fully was connecting with it personally until the Sunday following his funeral, when I walked into this building And right about where Ken Kiefer is sitting, there was a coffee sitting on the chair with a balloon tied behind it that said, in memory of Neil Hamlin, behind it. How many remember that? Yeah, a few people. So, for whatever reason, that was the moment that the veneer peeled away, and I completely lost my composure. I had to go downstairs into the men's room, where I spent the better part of the next 10 minutes trying to collect myself. I think I wept so uncontrollably that I looked in the mirror. I could hardly recognize myself, so I'm splashing cold water all over my face. Just so when I came back up, my wife would know that it was me who was sitting next to her when I sat down, right over there where Wilfred and his wife are sitting, is where I went back up and sat. And what happened to me next is almost impossible for me to describe, only to tell you that in the past that I would have said that if somebody told me the story that I'm about to tell you, being a mental health professional, I would have said, well, that's psychosis. Or fabrication, maybe somebody's just making it up. Maybe they're overdramatic, maybe they've got some kind of a wish to have some kind of a special experience, or whatever the case may be. And you know, people often do that with experiences that don't fit into their tidy categories. You know, they dismiss them and they demean them. And I really can claim no different exception to that. Because in the past, I would have done the exact same thing, and I've been guilty of doing that. That's one limit to human spirituality, is that we often place our confidences on the benchmark of our own experience, and we poo-poo that everyone else tells us to be true for them. In the face of any or all evidence, human beings will often ignore uncomfortable challenges to their own perspectives and throw stones at those who think differently. That's just something that happens. And you see it a lot these days when people are expressing all kinds of different perspectives about all kinds of different things. But at the time in question, I said I was sitting right there, I'm looking out that window, and I used to like to walk around this circle and pray back in the day. And the fall in particular was really special to me because before they built that apartment building over there, whatever it was, there was a field of sumac there that would turn bright red, and it was beautiful. And I used to like to look out the windows here as I was walking around at the sumac. And so I'm just sitting there staring out the window because I wasn't able to concentrate on what was going on the platform anyway. I was still pretty wrapped up in my own emotions. And as best as I can tell, I experienced in that moment a shift in consciousness that I've never been able to fully describe and explain. It was as if a veneer was peeled back on reality, and I was looking at a whole new dimension. I've read about this. I've heard about, you know, them using seminary students to induce this using things like peyote and other hallucinogenics. And I know that when they talk about Buddhist monks meditating, they're achieving this state of something very similar to what I thought I was experiencing at the time. But in that moment, for some reason, just hold with me for a second, it was as if I was no longer seeing trees and sumac and people or myself. It was like everything that it was a part of the reality that I was experiencing was just this one thing, this one great big web of energy, and I was so startled by it that I could do very little else in that moment but hold my breath and gaze at that incredible scene. And the other odd thing was, you know, I came up here feeling the heaviness of the loss of Neil. And suddenly, he felt as real to me in that moment as he did when he was fully alive. And so, my first conscious thought was, and some of you may think this weird, but my first conscious thought was, so this is what ineffable means. In theology, that word ineffable is the word that's used to describe things you can't explain, that words are inadequate, no matter how you try to describe it, you're not going to get close to it. Ineffable means inexpressible, not able to be explained. And I can say confidently that even now, as I try to explain it to you again, the descriptions just are so paltry compared to what I experienced in that moment that, you know, it's really not worth me even barely trying to describe it. So then I went from there, and you know, this may reveal a little bit to you about the way this mind works of mine. Pretty weird, I will admit, at times. I thought, well, this means that Neil always was and always will be. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, I will admit that. It doesn't mean that at all. But that is what I thought in the moment. If he's as real to me now as he was before he died, then maybe he always was and he always will be. And as I thought that, whatever heaviness that I was feeling just lifted from my chest, and I felt this sense of pure joy, I guess is the best way that I can describe it. I've never felt anything like that in my life prior. I haven't felt anything since. All I can tell you is that in the past, I would have denied this being anything more than temporary psychosis. I would have seen it as a psychedelic trip. I probably would have quoted Scrooge and said a bit of undigested beef and potato from the Christmas Carol, however you want to look at it, because nothing about that experience fit with my tidy preconceived ideas. And as that moment began to fade and I eased back into this room and into the construct that is our world, I thought, so this is why people hug trees. You know, I always wondered about that. You know, what is it that makes people hug trees? And I thought, this must be the reason why. It was 45 seconds at the most. I don't even know if it was that. Mere blip in the experience that was my life, less than a minute that challenged everything that I thought I ever knew. And then, in a voice louder than I intended, I said, what in the heck was that? Except I didn't say heck. Yes, that's what I said. It was really quite embarrassing, you know. Some of you may remember that account from my novel, Chapter 10 of In Praise of Uncertainty, where I talk about it a little bit more in depth. But the reason I share it now, the reason I thought it might be a helpful story now, is to simply illustrate that I get why Peter, James, and John didn't say anything when they came down off that mountaintop experience, because I didn't say anything, not to Debbie or anyone else after that moment. I might have said something to Debbie. I don't remember if I did or I didn't, but I didn't tell anyone else about it and didn't talk about it for quite a long time. I was very quiet, and people are often confused by that, because if someone experiences something that's powerful and transcendent, why not tell everyone? Why not shout it from the rooftops, get everybody in on the experience, and let others have some concept of what you went through? But what I found when I look at my history, not only in that moment, but throughout my life, it has not been my pattern to talk about my, what I'd like to say are defining moments, while they're still fresh. Because to me, you know, when I look at when people do that, when they've done it and I've been part of that, and when I imagine doing it myself, I feel it's grandstanding. You know, I don't want to be seen as someone who's grandstanding in some way. And any time I've had any kind of experience that's kind of pushed me to a deeper level, it first makes me go into this place of deep reverence and reflection to ask, what does this mean? You know, for me, what does this mean? What is this moment about? Because, you know, there's nothing I could have said then or even now that will have added a single solitary thing to what I just experienced. All it would have done if I would have said something in my mind was invite skepticism, like I'm sure some of you are experiencing right now. I don't blame you. If I was in your seat, I might be skeptical about it as well. So I don't blame you for that. It was my experience after all. But assigning some deep existential meaning to it seems to me like the epitome of presumption and vanity. So I'm not going to do that today, and I did not do it then. I'm just telling you what happened. Because just because I experienced it doesn't mean it, you know, it deserves some kind of extrapolation about the meaning of life, or you know, what that says about God or anything else. It is what it is. Framing explanations, creating arguments or theologies after an experience like that is not what is needed. All I could do in that moment is stand in awe and feel gratitude for the experience and for the gift I was given. That was it. Awe and gratitude. The two mental dispositions that come with the concept of thanksgiving. Awe and gratitude are enough. And I think that's why James and John and Peter were quiet. They were in awe, they experienced gratitude, and I suppose that was enough. One cannot underestimate the importance of gratitude. I'm trying to remember, I probably should have looked it up before I came up here this morning, who made the comment that if you call someone ungrateful, you can call them no worse. Gratitude is really critically important. And it's an attitude with universal importance. Not everyone experiences spirituality the same way. Not all religions frame their thinking the same way, but they all see this value in the idea of being thankful and experiencing gratitude. And I think all of them, in their own ways, create awe and gratitude according to their own experience. Awe and gratitude, in other words, are not exclusively a Christian concept. So if you think differently about that idea, you might want to take what I'm about to say next with a grain of salt. It's just an expression of my take on the spiritual life, but one that's of great benefit to me in remaining grateful. I'm hopeful that it may be helpful to you in some of your uncertain times. What I like to say is that spirituality has three postures, or what I've come to describe as three glances. Probably a dozen years or so ago, I was sitting in here during one of our services. I don't remember what the sermon was about that day, but suddenly I had this idea of the three glances to describe our walk with God, the upward glance, the inward glance, and the outward glance. And I decided I've got to think about that a little more and round that out to see what that means for me, and that's what I'm doing today. So the three postures or the three glances, there's the upward glance that connects us with the Creator and inspires gratitude and awe, kind of like I've been saying in this message. There's the inward glance that connects that awe with our own story. And I've found what it does for me is it creates humility. Don't laugh, Deb. I can pull it off. Then there's the outward glance that humbly connects all of that with those around us and inspires love. Other people may experience it differently, but on this Thanksgiving Sunday, I'd like us to take a few minutes, not a long time, to talk about each and the importance that I place on a spirituality that is rounded in all three glances. So we've already been talking about that upward glance a bit and the possibility of being surprised by God in some way, and that's what I felt in my experience after Neil died, and I'm expecting Peter and James and John might have experienced after the transfiguration, because just when I think I've got everything figured out, you know, theologians like to do that. They like to get things cornered, create a systematic theology, have everything figured out, all their angles covered. Every time I think I've got that, something happens to make me think again. And I think our experience with God is like that. And it should be if we're open. We should be open to being invaded at times by God. We're forever trying to explain and understand God theologically, and that's good to a point. I think we all need hooks on which to hang our understandings of the world, and that's what theology does for it. It helps us to create categories and safety and security in being confident in beliefs. And so theology does help organize our thinking, but sometimes it can also get in the way. I've had six watershed experiences I can count in my life, these moments that where things happened that shifted the energy of my life and my perspective and moved me in a different direction. I'm not going to bore you with the specifics of that, but every one of them left me sensing an aspect of God that was too big to explain and too personal to use as a standard for anyone other than me. And it took me a while to realize that that was okay. You know, when I was listening to people talk about their experience with God, the first section that you did with your prayer, John, I was struck by how many people use language like personal, intimate, to explain that relationship. And, unlike many who need an answer to everything, My takeaway throughout my life has been is that I'm strangely comforted by the idea that God is so great that God cannot be reduced to a cataloged set of beliefs or expectations. I've come to think how wonderful it is that God is ineffable. Those six or so watershed experiences are the most powerful of my life, and every one of them shattered what I previously believed to be important and left me in awe of a presence I could sense, but I could not fully understand, and I like that. I'm so grateful that the ineffable keeps invading my space and inspiring me and making me think again, because it seems like inspiration is always just around the corner if you're open to receiving it. But you know, the other part of that, and I had to learn this as well, I've had great conversations with people about that, particularly around the experience I shared earlier. Awe for awe's sake is mere self-indulgence. If all you're doing is going around trying to get your spiritual jollies from spiritual experiences, that's not very deep either. It's great to have experiences that feel good, but seeking to feel good, that's not for me. Self-indulgent spirituality is very tempting, but it's not for me. Awe is important because it leads to this second glance that I'd like to talk about, and that's the inward glance that inspires humility. That's what my experience after Neil's death did for me. It made me self-reflective. And the one takeaway that came from that is that I had this sense, however it worked out, that I am a cog in the wheel and nothing more. I'm just one. I'm just one thing that's part of one greater thing. I'm just a cog in the wheel and nothing more. I'm not important and I'm not unimportant. I'm the same. That was my takeaway, and it reinforced in a whole new way my utter dependence on God, but it also did on you and on everything else that makes up this world and in the universe in which we reside. I'm not sure a time has ever existed when us grasping the importance of this interdependence has been more important, at least not in my lifetime. Ecologically, politically, socially, and in just about every way you can relate to other people, it's so important we grasp this idea of the unity of all things. The inward glance urges us to be fully present when a gift is being given by God and to pay attention to what's happening to us and in us at that moment, and being willing to question what we think. Just because it's not what we've always thought doesn't mean we shouldn't spend time saying, what does this mean for me? Being open to understanding this one critically important thing is no one is above anyone else or any less dependent on all that is. We are all only one human family. So whatever you think about the concept of the unity of all things and energy being one thing and us all being part of this one fabric that we call oneness, I don't even place a theological perspective on that. My takeaway is we're all one human family and we got to do it together or it doesn't get done at all. Particularly at a time like this when a self-proclaimed demagogue like Putin imagines himself greater than everyone and anything, it's threatening nuclear annihilation of the world. We've got Joe Biden talking about Armageddon. You know, pretty scary stuff. I'm old enough to remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was too young to be as scared as I should have been and old enough to know that it was scary. I remember having to do drills under my desk at school. So in case a nuclear event happened, you know, we'd be hiding under our desks as if something like that was going to help us at all, but we did it. Anyway, he may talk a good game and swing a big bat, but you know, Putin knows he can die in his sleep tonight. And any idea of control is a perception that can vanish in a single moment. And anyone who looks honestly at their truth, anyone who just takes any time at all to take that inner glance and see how dependent they are on everyone and everything, cannot help but be humbled by that idea, feel gratitude. It's not all on your shoulders. You know, we have others we can rely on as well. And think more broadly. Awe says God exists, that there's this benevolent power that's greater than us, that thrusts us into this common reliance. one we can either acknowledge and respect, or we can tear at the fabric of it, like humans like to do when we get a little too self-absorbed and self-important. Humility says we are not that power and must rely on everyone and everything for even the simplest of things. Awe and humility provide us with perspective, the upward glance and the inward glance that ultimately leads to this outward glance or the glance of love. I know that everyone who's read the teachings of Jesus know that it all boils down to that. All of Christ's teachings are ultimately meant to move us toward loving our neighbors as ourselves. And when Jesus talks about the meaning of that, it's not just the people we like, it's loving our enemies, it's loving the dispossessed, the foreigner, the alien. And we're being reminded in these times how difficult that task is. You know, we thought that the pandemic amplified these challenges with the tensions of trying to figure out the balance between caring for ourselves and protecting the common good. My role at Waypoint is in ethics. And just about every consult that we did that had anything at all to do with the pandemic was trying to balance the personal needs with that of the common good. That's the tension. We thought getting a shot and wearing a mask tested our interdependence and exposed something of who we truly were at the core. Putin put all of that into perspective by deciding to force his will and disturb the entire world, and now we're all thinking about that, or at least I am. I'm thinking about it. Because something he believes is more important than any of those other things, I suppose, is what he's focusing on. And in so doing, the interesting thing is that the whole world, including the good people of Russia, are again being reminded of how deeply connected we all are. We all are part of this. We love our neighbor as ourselves because we are our neighbor in a spiritual sense. We can't do to our neighbor without doing to us. So the outward glance reminds us that, like it or not, that's what we are. We're truly in this whole thing together, not just in the sense of this pandemic or the various wars that conflict and regularly erupt upon the earth, but in everything. And as I thought about that, it reminded me of William Shatner, who went up in one of those rockets. I can't remember which, Blue Origin, I think it was. And after playing the guy who was out in space for most of his career, he's looking back at the Earth, and suddenly he experiences this great awe that I've been talking about. He saw it altogether different, because from space, a mile is a millimeter in the globe of marble, and he could see that all the boundaries that we think exist are just an illusion. So what astronauts see with their eyes, we can know in our hearts with the simple Christian acknowledgement that the upward glance, however we express it, and the inward glance, however we practice it, mean nothing if we do not embrace the outward glance, that we cannot love God, whom we have not seen, if we do not love one another, whom we have seen. A Cherokee wise man once said that rather than thinking I'm born with rights, I can choose to think I am born with obligation to serve past, present, and future generations and the planet herself. I think that's what it means to be human. You know, love focuses less on what I think I'm owed or entitled to, and more on what I can contribute. So like it or not, we're all part of what's unfolding here. We're all part of this global community. And every one of us in these times has to figure out how we're going to play that part. Because great good and great evil are possible in these days. And contribution rather than exploitation makes more sense to me. And so we have to all decide how we're going to participate in the larger human family and what that might mean in our own choices right now. So if we've not been in the practice previously, this may be a really good time to ask the one question being a Christian requires us to place front and center in every decision we make, and it was kind of made into a meme at one point, but it's more than a meme. It's the absolute gospel truth about life. What would Jesus do if he were navigating these times? Because I think he would look up, he would look within, and he would look without, and he would do what would best represent the heart of God. And that's about as much as anyone can ask of anyone. And what on this Thanksgiving Sunday I'm thinking about and I'm offering to you. Let's bow together in prayer. Our great and ineffable God, on this Thanksgiving Sunday, we remember that you are greater than we can imagine and more than we can think. Inspire us with those thoughts and bless us in our own places. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.